This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Egypt has just suffered some of its worst attacks on its Christians in decades. What does it mean for Egypt, for the Middle East, for the Vatican, and for the world? Today we'll also discuss Ethiopia extending its state of emergency. The unrest in Ethiopia is leaving some space for a very dangerous power to become even stronger. We'll also discuss transhumanism, a movement that sounds a lot like science fiction, but that is quickly becoming a reality. Will people be able to soon live hundreds or even thousands of years? And what are the moral implications of these advancements? And then finally, for the last word, we'll talk about the value of learning how to say a certain small word. If you look at the Middle East, about a century ago, various kinds of Christian groups made up about 30% of the region's total population. 30%. But today that number is down to just 3% or less. The Christians have been fleeing the area in droves, and it's largely because Muslim groups have been targeting Christians, persecuting them, and driving them out. In Egypt, just since the fall of Hosni Mubarak back in 2011, more than 100,000 Coptic Christians have fled the country. But the persecution on the Coptic Christians who remain in Egypt continues. And on Sunday of this week, one of the deadliest attacks on Egypt's Christians in decades was carried out on some Coptic churches. To tell us about this, we have via Skype from our British office, trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. Hello there, Brent.
Hey, Jeremiah. How you doing?
Doing well, thank you. Maybe you could just start off by bringing us up to speed on the details of those attacks, where they happened, and the casualty figures and things like that.
Right. So as you said, there were two separate attacks that took place in northern Egypt, just above, one in Alexandria and the other in the city of Tanta, which is halfway between Alexandria and Cairo. So right up there in the Nile Delta. And these were two separate attacks, happened on Sunday, Palm Sunday, the beginning of Holy Week for Catholics throughout the world. And the first ones were, they were both suicide bombing attacks. And they both were really in areas or in churches that had a lot of security. This was part of this the policy by Mr. Sisi, the president of Egypt, to secure these Coptic Christian sites because he was aware that there were potential attacks to take place. And yet, even with that security, these two men were successful. The one that took place in St. George's Church in Tanta, happened while the main doors were sealed, as the suicide bomber, he slipped through the side door, past security, and eventually was able to make it to the altar. And while they were singing hymns, he blew himself up, killing about 27 people. And then 2 hours later, north in Alexandria, while Pope Tawadros, he's the leader of the Coptics in Egypt, he was giving his message, and surveillance footage shows a man approaching the entrance, the gates to the church, and he was stopped by a security guard, forced to go through a security detector, and then he was Then he was questioned, at which point, I guess, realizing that his cover has been blown, and he decided to blow himself up. And there were 17 people that were killed with that attack.
So the total comes to 44 dead, is that right?
Around that, but I would expect that to rise just because there's people in hospital, a lot of people are injured through these attacks that do have life-threatening injuries.
Yeah, and the you mentioned that this was Palm Sunday. That seems beyond coincidence. Do you think that the Islamists were specifically targeting, you know, sort of a sacred day for the Christians?
Oh, of course, of course. This is their policy. I mean, if they're going to do the most damage attack on a symbolic day, make people think twice before they go to one of these churches, make them think twice before they celebrate their holy days. So for sure, this was planned.
Who is responsible for the attacks? Has anyone claimed responsibility?
The Islamic State has, we know of the Islamic State's affiliate that controls parts of the Sinai Peninsula. For years, they've controlled parts of the Sinai Peninsula, and then they gradually, after the Islamic State grew inside Syria and Iraq, they basically joined that group, pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. And for the past couple of years, they have really gone after the Egyptian government, the Egyptian military in the Sinai Peninsula, and even into the main thrust of Egypt as well. But lately, it seems that they are beginning to attack Christians, Coptic Christians, even more than the Egyptian military, and they have claimed responsibility for this. They said, I believe it was on their website, they said, quote, "The Crusaders and their apostate followers must be aware that the bill between us and them is very large, and they will be paying it like a river of blood from their sons, if God is willing." So they're not backing down. They're looking at the amount of people that were killed by the Catholic Crusaders from centuries gone by, and they said that they've got a large debt to repay in blood against the Christians.
That's pretty staggering. I think in the Western world, we think of the Crusades as ancient history. We think, you know, that was a tragic situation. All of those campaigns, it was bloody, but the history book is closed on that. It's over. But, you know, as you said there, with the Islamists, that's still a fresh wound. It's still something that they perceive as an injustice that they're still trying to set right.
For sure. And it is something that, you know, we need to consider. The history, while it has been, the study of history has been largely ignored in the Western world, has been maligned even in universities in the Western world. History runs through the Middle East, and they remember it. They remember events going back hundreds of years, and really they really believe that war debt is going to be replayed with Christian blood, and they're going after it.
What's your read on the Islamic State these days? We know that they're sort of on the back foot there in Iraq and Syria, but what about in Egypt? Like, do these savage attacks signal that they are still powerful in Egypt?
I think it does. I think it does for sure. This group, the Islamic State here in Egypt, predated the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. It just went by a different name. So I think regardless of what's happening in Syria and Iraq, we're going to see this group probably stay inside Egypt.
Okay, this group, they're affiliated with the Islamic State. What is their relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood that we know is it has been very powerful in Egypt, but it's currently being suppressed a great deal by President Sisi?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, they aren't affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, though we see that when their goals and their desires do align, that's when you have these groups, these terrorist groups, and also Muslim Brotherhood obviously isn't as savage as the Islamic State, and yet both of them have a goal to destroy Sisi's government, to bring that down, because he has been a strong arm against any type of political Islam, any type of bringing Islam to the front of government, to making Sharia law. We know that they wanted to institute Sharia law under Mohammed Morsi back when the Muslim Brotherhood was in power, and Sisi has put a stop to that. He's really the only one he's the reason that we don't have this crusade, really, against the Christians by the Islamic State and other Muslim groups, extremist groups in Egypt. We don't have it bubbling to the surface, or at least it's not as obvious as it could be, is because of his rule. I mean, I firmly believe that if he was not in power right now, we would have these type of attacks every weekend, not just on these holy days when a couple of them managed to get through security. Because of his power, we haven't seen the full extent of the hatred towards the Coptics that we may see. Now, as to the extent that the Muslim Brotherhood has with the Islamic State, that is hard to tell right now. I wouldn't say that they are working together closely, but I would say that their goals align at this moment. And both of them see an attack on the Christians as a way of undermining Sisi's rule.
So a common enemy there really brings their ideology together in some big ways. What has Sisi's reaction been so far to these attacks?
Well, he has come out and he gave a strong speech on Sunday talking about how he's not going to differentiate between Christians and Muslims in these attacks because we're all Egyptians. And while that sounds good, and while that did keep Egypt together for a number of years, in the sense that if you go back to Mubarak's time, I mean, your stats that you gave at the beginning there talked about the exodus from Egypt that started post-Mubarak. Why did not start before Mubarak? Because he didn't believe in political Islam. It didn't matter if you're a Christian or if you're a Muslim, you can live in Egypt. And that's the way it is. You have fundamental rights. That changed after Mubarak was deposed. And that's when the exodus started out of Egypt under Morsi and has continued ever since, because people like the idea of political Islam ruling. They like the idea, some people do, of Christians being targeted. So while Sisi might come and say that we're all Egyptians, there's plenty of Egyptians that don't believe that and that wish these Christians harm. So he's announced that he's going to have 3 months under state of emergency, which is, I don't know how many more powers that would give him, since he already has a lot of strong power inside Egypt. He is an authoritarian and he rules with a strong arm, and he does. A lot of human rights are being sidelined with the way that he rules. So I don't want him to paint him out as just a benevolent figure in any way. But when it comes to dealing with Islamists, he seems to know how to do it. So he's got three months, if the parliament approves it, which they likely will, of state of emergency.
And Mr. Sisi has recently visited U.S. President Donald Trump. And it sounds like the two of them have found a lot of common ground. Mr. Trump seems like he's willing to excuse a lot of those human rights violations in favor of sort of forging a bit of a partnership with Sisi, possibly, well, mostly because Mr. Trump sees that Sisi does want to suppress the most radical Islamist elements in Egypt. What's your view of that relationship between Sisi and Mr. Trump, and how do you think that affects the broader Middle East?
Well, I do think, yeah, that relationship is strong. We did see even Mr. Trump tweeted soon after these attacks that he trusted that Mr. Sisi would deal with it in the right way. And you just have the choice. When it comes to Egypt, you have a good examples of the two types of leadership that can only exist there. Sisi fully understands that if he wasn't in power, it would be great to have democracy, but you are going to have, as we saw, a democratic party come into power that is more favorable towards putting Islam or making Islam play a more central role in the way the government is governed, where the people are governed. And if that's the case, we would see more attacks against Christians. We would see more of what we see in other parts of the Middle East that have religious autocracies or theocracies. And so that relationship between the two looks quite strong. The fundamental pillar to Middle Eastern peace for so long has been the presence of the United States. And if he is, if Mr. Trump is going to take precedent as an example to guide him in how to stabilize in any way the Middle East, he would, it would, you would think that he would try and create a strong alliance with Egypt as it was for 30 years with Mubarak. That really did stabilize a lot of the Middle East. So he's trying to follow that same type of foreign policy.
Pope Francis is scheduled to visit Egypt in a couple of weeks. I wonder what you think about the Vatican's view of, well, just the long-term trend that we've seen in the Middle East of Islamists driving so many Christians out. I mean, if you go back far enough before the Islamic incursion, much of this region was almost completely populated by Christians. And now the very last vestiges of Christendom, in some cases, are just fleeing in droves, and Islamists are persecuting the ones that remain with these kinds of savage attacks like the ones that we saw on Palm Sunday. So how long do you think that the Vatican will disregard this exodus of the Middle East's Christians?
I'm surprised they've been disregarding it for as long as they have, really. And you say the Vatican, I think that's a good way of putting it, because if you look at the Pope before Francis, Pope Benedict the 16th, when there was an attack against Coptic Christians back in 2011, and what he said in a speech after that is that he said, quote, he appealed to Christians saying, in the face of the threatening tensions of the moment, especially in the face of discrimination, of abuse of power, and religious intolerance that today particularly strikes Christians, I again direct a pressing invitation not to yield to discouragement and resignation. He's saying, I'm aware of it. Don't yield to it. And while he didn't say we're coming to save you, it was seemed like that was his the trend underneath Benedict. Now, once Francis came into power, and it's under him that we have seen the greatest exodus of Christians from the Middle East, there hasn't been as strong of statements. Of course, he will come out, and he has already, I believe, and saying how horrible this is. But when governments don't act to protect the Christians of the Middle East, as they haven't in Iraq and Syria and other places, you would expect the Catholic Church to try and mobilize. While they don't have an army, they have a lot of political power over especially nations in Europe, to try and motivate some type of action to protect these Christians. But as to now, it hasn't happened. Historically looking at it, it has happened many times. Many times.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do expect there to come a turning point. I don't know after which act, what act it would take for the Catholic Church or for the Vatican, for the Pope in particular, to say enough is enough. It hasn't happened yet. But prophecy indicates it is going to happen. And if more of these attacks continue, maybe it is coming soon.
Well, that sounds like that's a really important hot spot for us to keep an eye on there. We really appreciate your time there, Brent.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The government of Ethiopia announced recently that the state of emergency that the country has been in for months will be extended for another 4 months. This ancient country on the Horn of Africa has been suffering spates of unrest and violence and attacks from what it says are foreign-backed militias supported by neighboring countries Egypt and Eritrea. And so the government is now responding with this extension of the state of emergency. This ends up really empowering the Ethiopian government. The regime can restrict travel of citizens. Its military can enforce curfews. It can search premises and even detain individuals without any kind of search warrant. So it really gives the regime a lot of power, and it has some worrying implications. Trumpet writer Anthony Chibadirwe has written a powerful article about this. The article is called Ethiopia Extends State of Emergency, which you can find on thetrumpet.com. And he's in the studio today to bring us up to speed on this development and its implications. Thank you for coming on the show today, Anthony.
Good to be here.
Well, maybe you could begin with just some of the details of when this state of emergency was originally instated and why, and also just what prompted the recent extension of it.
As you mentioned in that introduction, on March 30th, the Ethiopian government announced that it's going to extend a state of emergency that had already been in place. There was a unanimous vote in the Ethiopian parliament in favor of it. So the original one was enacted back in October last year. And here's the gist of the whole matter. It's the government, as you mentioned, is very unstable, and the populace is also also unstable, and it's also divided along ethnic lines. So that has been a huge factor in this problem. And then you have the government that's also unstable, and it's somewhat dictatorial. So the government has been using heavy-handed tactics against the people who are demonstrating against the government. The people are demonstrating against the government's heavy-handed tactics, and then the government is responding by heavy-handed tactics. So what you actually have is this vicious cycle that just keeps going on and on and on. October 11 was the day when they enacted this state of emergency, and that was after anti-government protesters attacked foreign-owned factories and killed an American student. And like I said, it's a vicious cycle, because a week before that state of emergency, the government forces had fired rubber bullets, tear gas at protesters who were at a cultural festival. And that attack from the government triggered a stampede that killed 52 people, according to what the government itself actually admits. But the opposition said that about 600 people were killed. So at any rate, this didn't stop the anti-government protesters, and it led up to all these problems that have resulted ever since. When the government enacted that state of emergency, they estimated that this could last for 6 months. They were hoping that by April they would just completely scrap it off, but more and more of those problems have been popping up in Ethiopia, so they decided to extend it.
Ethiopia is considered, really a powerhouse in the region. How does that power factor into this situation?
I think that's a great question. I think its location in the Horn of Africa region is very critical, especially when you consider some of its neighbors. They are not the most stable neighbors. You can consider Yemen. You can consider it at least a country within its periphery. Mm-hmm. It's right there in the Red Sea. And then you also have Eritrea. You have Djibouti. And a little south, you have Kenya. And Somalia, of course, and a lot of these countries have been facing a lot of attacks from Islamic terrorists. So that is probably the key point that our readers need to take, readers and listeners need to take note of. The instability of this region has implications that are global. When you have the chaos that's been going on in Ethiopia, it's not insignificant. Under the state of emergency, some people say hundreds of people have been killed. Tens of thousands have been detained. So we have a really, really, really serious problem there. Some of the protesters were saying that our goal is to paralyze the economic muscle of the regime and to bring it to its knees. So, like I said, it's a vicious cycle. So what it means that we can expect these problems to go on. So why should this matter? I guess that could be a question that our listeners might be asking. Why does this all matter? Mm-hmm. I think to answer that, we have to go to the Bible. Because an Ethiopian, the Ethiopian defense minister, he said that we are extending the state of emergency because there are people who occasionally strive to disrupt our peace and our security. So why does this matter? And who are those people? You mentioned that the Ethiopian government has publicly named Eritrea and Egypt as being behind some of those demonstrations. But there could be more players, and the Bible helps us with that. Ethiopia is one of a handful of nations that are named in the Bible by the name that they currently have.
Right.
Of course, the Bible talks about the United States. It talks about Britain, but it uses their ancient names. But with countries like Ethiopia, the Bible uses that name. If you search your Bible for Ethiopia, you will find it. So I think that alone ought to just make everyone want to find out more about what's going on in this country if there are these demonstrations that go on for months and months and months, and the state of emergency is extended for months and months and months. I think that that ought to get our readers looking into the Bible, looking at some of those prophecies. And the key prophecy is in Daniel 11. And that prophecy mentions Ethiopia. It mentions the king of the south. And it mentions the king of the north. And from our literature, the king of the north is a European power. The king of the south is Iran. Mm-hmm. And it mentions Ethiopia there as being somewhat aligned with Iran. So this is the real, the crux of the matter here. You have a government that's saying that we have these demonstrations in the country, and these demonstrations, they are triggered by foreign players. And we know this prophecy that talks about a nation that is notorious for meddling in foreign nations, especially nations in the Horn of Africa region, in Yemen, for example. Iran is there. And yes. Iran has also been meddling with in Eritrea as well. In Somalia, you have the Al-Shabaab terrorists. They are just terrorizing that region, terrorizing Kenyans, and terrorizing anyone who has been trying to stop them.
Yeah, Al-Shabaab has been becoming more and more active in that region from the reports that I've seen. Is that right?
It has been, and the African Union has assembled a coalition of forces from all these different nations in that region that have been trying to stop them. And so Al-Shabaab has been going after each and every country that is part of this African Union force, and Ethiopia is one of them. And we know that Al-Shabaab is aligned with Al-Qaeda and with Iran. So this is something very critical, and this is something that Iran can easily take advantage of. If it is actually true that Egypt is meddling in Ethiopia and Eritrea is meddling in Ethiopia, I don't think it's far-fetched to say that Iran can easily just do that to make sure that it secures that the Horn of Africa region and the Red Sea passageway right there.
Yeah, so many of those countries that you mentioned there, Yemen, Somalia, Ethiopia is landlocked, but if it were to reunite with Eritrea, which it very easily could if this unrest sort of continued to boil to the surface and possibly lead to a broader war there. So many of those countries are right there on the Red Sea. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has really drawn a lot of attention to the Red Sea, and specifically Iran, as you mentioned, their desire to control it. What could you tell us about that and how that factors into this?
I like the point that you mentioned about Ethiopia's location, because it's landlocked, like you said, but then it's only separated by a thin strip of Eritrea right there. Mm-hmm. And this is fairly something that happened recently. Originally, it was just one nation. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, in his booklet about Ethiopia, he mentions that when the Bible talks about Ethiopia, it could be referring to that region. It's referring to Ethiopia and the nations in its periphery. So it still is important to watch whatever happens in Eritrea affects Ethiopia, and whatever happens in Ethiopia affects Eritrea. It affects Djibouti, and it affects that passageway. So it's not far-fetched to see to speculate that Iran would have a vested interest in Ethiopia, even though it's not connected to the sea. If it gains control of Ethiopia, it just gives it more control of that whole region.
And all of this unrest in Ethiopia, the ongoing frictions that we see there, it seems to me that that just opens it up for more and more influence by a power like Iran. If it's unstable, if it's having to declare these states of emergency and extend them, possibly indefinitely, then that just opens the door for foreign influence all the more. Well, Anthony has written an article about this on thetrumpet.com. It's called Ethiopia Extends State of Emergency. So please head over to thetrumpet.com to check that out. Anthony, we really appreciate you bringing us up to speed on this development. Thank you for your time.
Good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour.
Transhumanism. That's the name of a somewhat new and very strange movement that has been gaining traction in the developed world over the last few decades. Its advocates want something bigger than all those people that we see crusading for civil rights or women's rights or the LGBT cause. Transhumanists want to, as they see it, liberate mankind from our biological constraints. They want to harness the power of technology to let people live longer, to push beyond the 120-year mark that seems to be our current upper limit. They want to push to 200 years, 300 years, even 1,000 years. Some even say that we can learn to upload human consciousness into a computer and thereby live forever. And that's not all. Transhumanists say biotechnology could allow us to make ourselves stronger, smarter, and less prone to violence. So those longer lives will be not just longer, but also of a higher quality. As technology keeps on advancing, some of these ideas are becoming less and less of a science fiction dream and more of a scientific possibility. But the question is, should people live for 1,000 years? Should we try to extend our lifespans possibly indefinitely? Trumpet writer Andrew Miller is in the process of writing an article on this topic. He is here in the studio with us to talk about this today. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what are the nuts and bolts of this transhumanist movement, the specific technological implementations being suggested that would supposedly let people start to kind of outmaneuver nature and live for centuries?
Right. Well, this is a movement that's been around for probably the past 50 years on the fringes, mm-hmm. but just now really making headway into the mainstream. It's on the cover of this month's National Geographic, and many other major newspapers have picked this up, showing that there's a lot of like high-ranking officials in Silicon Valley who are really pushing this as one of the next big things. But in a nutshell, the argument is that it's mostly put forward by people who believe in human evolution. Mm-hmm. And the claim is that for the last 200 million years, natural selection has been the primary driver that's in human evolution. The weak die off, the strong survive, and then at least according to the theory, people are getting genetically better and better.
Right.
But now they're also making the claim that in the past 200 years, natural selection's kind of stalled. Because we have welfare programs that help the poor, we have hospitals that help the sick, we've got mental facilities that help the mentally ill, and that a lot of people who in the past would have died off and not passed their genes on to the next generation are now passing their genes on to the next generation. But unlike the early 20th century eugenics movements which actually just tried to sterilize or kill off those that they claimed were inferior, the transhumanist movement is really staying the standpoint that actually technology has advanced to the point where mankind can become their own creator, saying that now if you find someone who's has some genetic disease, the gene splicing technology is almost to the point where you can go in, cut out the defective gene, splice in a new gene, and cure yourself of that disease. Or it was also a fairly well scientific fact that the human heart's good for only about 2 billion beats. After that, it's worn out. But with the transhumanist movement, was saying that, like, okay, well, you can have a mechanical heart, and just like you change your alternator out on your Corvette every few 100,000 miles or so, you can switch out your heart every few 100 miles and so. And by splicing your genetics and augmenting your biological body with mechanical parts, they're claiming that within the next generation, you'll be able to break about that 120-year barrier and have human beings living 200. Like I said, mentioned earlier, there's one prominent scientist in California who's claiming that he thinks the first human being to live to 1,000 years is alive already today.
Wow. In your view, where do you think the line is here in terms of, like, sheer feasibility of biotechnology? Like, how much of this do you think is scientifically possible? Could we make a fully biomechanical heart? And then also, I know that some of the advocates of this movement are talking about even uploading human consciousness into a computer. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that's definitely the end goal of the transhumanist movement, is to get to some point where you can actually upload human consciousness into a computer and then basically live forever, because whenever that computer wears out, you can just upload to a newly built computer and newly built computer. And obviously those coming at this from an evolutionary standpoint think that may be possible within the next 3 or 4 decades. Anyone who comes at it from a standpoint that human intellect is bestowed by a spiritual element within the human mind would claim that that will never happen. And so that's definitely coming from a Christian background will claim that uploading the human consciousness is something that is beyond the realm of human capability. But in some cases, like even a pacemaker is a mechanical piece that extends the human life by having your heart last longer than it otherwise would.
Yeah.
And that technology, as you get into like gene splicing and mechanical body parts, if it'll get to the point where you could live 1,000 years, but it's probably definitely scientifically feasible to get to a point where you're living much longer than 120.
What can you tell us about some of the moral arguments against this quest for, say, allowing a person to live 1,000 years?
Well, there's one particular political scientist, Francis Fukuyama, who... he's written a couple years ago, back 2009, a piece for Foreign Policy calling transhumanism the world's most dangerous ideology. And basically his argument comes to the standpoint is that from a religious standpoint, you come in at that all human beings are endowed with equal rights by their creator, which is God. Even from an evolutionary standpoint, there is at least some feeling that we have certain responsibilities to each other as members of the same species. But since these gene splicing operations are very expensive, there's a concern that only the rich would be able to afford them. And then you would get a lot of problems similar to what you had in like the early eugenics movement, where you've got like an upper class of people who are living 500 years long and have superior intelligence due to this genetic enhancements. But the poor are still the poor, and they're still bound by the old regular just natural human limitations, and that you get like an overlord class where people oppress each other because they feel superior. I mean, we've definitely seen that throughout human history, just like monsters like Adolf Hitler or who oppress other races, other peoples, other nations due to they believe that they're biologically superior. And just knowing human nature to be what it is, if you could actually get a class of people that was genetically enhanced, or have someone like Hitler who lives for 1,000 years due to this enhancement, and then even you start getting all sorts of dystopian possibilities that start coming up. You have like, okay, well, who controls the science labs who do these enhancements? Yeah. Are you going to have corrupt governments who enhance their political lackeys and supporters to live 500 years while the opposition still is fighting to get past 75 before they've got to pass the baton on to the next generation?
Yeah, yeah, that raises some pretty serious questions. I don't think anyone would want to live in a world where someone like Adolf Hitler could use his power to extend his life, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, even up to 1,000 years. Yeah, well, following on the moral implications there, I wonder if you could just bring in the biblical viewpoint of how the scriptures speak to this sort of possibility.
Right. Well, that's one interesting thing, and I'm trying to remember what year it was published, but a few years ago, I think it was Scientific American or one of the key science magazines was pointing out some of what they considered the flaws of the human body. Mm-hmm. That and speculating like, how would an all-knowing, all-powerful God create a human body that has these flaws? They're trying to use it as a proof against the existence of God. Mm-hmm. But quickly overlooking the possibility is that just like a human engineer can design something that fails after a certain time, is like there is a strong biblical reason why God designed the human body to only live so long and then fail, is that, and obviously like we're talking about these dystopian scenarios of just like these corrupt evil men living for centuries or millennia and all the damage they could do, and even the misery they're in themselves, just in this fallen, just selfish condition. Yeah. And that obviously, like immortality without moral perfection is about the worst curse you could ever experience.
Yeah.
And so, which is why that God had specifically designed, and I mean, this is a trend throughout the Bible that after we live so long, we die, and then even contrary to the beliefs of many religions, there's no talk of like an immortal torment in hell. It says the soul that sins, it shall die, which right. is the most merciful thing that you could do to someone who's in such a miserable condition. And so God has designed this to where that if you choose to follow God's way of life, which brings happiness and which brings joy, he has promised, they said, the gift of God is eternal life. But he wants to make sure that once you receive eternal life, you're actually in a condition of moral purity where you can actually enjoy that without committing such atrocities, like Nazi level style atrocities. And so you get like a movement like this transhumanist movement, which it does really speak that mankind has a built-in desire to live forever.
Yeah.
But there's like, says, are they in a condition where that would actually be a good thing? And they're trying to like get around some of these boundaries that God has set a limit on human lifespan, just to make sure that this is a trying ground where you can try to say, if you can develop character, there is definitely a way put out in the scriptures that you can attain eternal life. But attempting to attain it in any other way, in an evil or sinful or fallen condition, is going to lead to just unspeakable levels of misery and atrocity, assuming it could ever be. And obviously, immortality is something that, if you believe in a spiritual element to human being, will never be obtained. But just even the idea of people living for 1,000 years in a state of like sin and fallen condition is something that's quite frightening when you think about it.
It really is, yes. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's working on an article right now about transhumanism. It's a fascinating topic. We thank you very much for that, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. That's a very familiar Bible passage found there in Ecclesiastes 9:10, and it's an invaluable admonition. It's ubiquitous. It's really precious wisdom. But did you know that there's something written kind of between the lines of that passage? You could phrase it as, only take on as many things as you can do with your might. Because really, if we're going to heed that admonition in Ecclesiastes 9:10 and do everything we do with our might, with our focus, with our strength, with our very best, then we have to be quite selective about the number of things we do or the number of things that we choose to take on. We are finite beings, after all. We have a finite and limited amount of strength, a limited amount of focus, and of course, a limited amount of time. That's the big one. So if we want to heed King Solomon's admonition there in Ecclesiastes, we really have to learn to say no to a great number of options and propositions and opportunities. If we say yes to everything, or even if we say yes to too many things, we won't be able to do them with our might. The American entrepreneur Derek Sivers has written on this topic. He said, quote, "Use this rule if you're often overcommitted or too scattered. If you're not saying an enthusiastic yeah about something, then say no. When deciding whether to do something, if you feel anything less than, wow, that would be amazing, absolutely, then say no. We're all busy. We've all taken on too much. Saying yes to less is the way out." End quote. Now, of course, the decision of what to say no to shouldn't be guided really by what we want to say no to, but it should be guided by what we should say no to. But still, the principle that Sivers is talking about there is right. When you say no to most things that are maybe just entertainment or of questionable value, then you leave space in your life to throw yourself fully into those rare things, those few priorities that are of vital and long-lasting importance. I've gone through semesters and years and months when I've said yes to too many things, many of them trivial, and it's quite uncomfortable to have to complete some of those more important assignments and other things at a level of quality that is not really done with your might. It's quite uncomfortable to know that you could be doing better, but that there's just so much on your plate that the time doesn't permit it. So you kind of have to do it without your might. You have to complete it to a degree that you know is not your best. It's an uncomfortable spot to be in. You end up feeling sort of thin, like butter spread over too much toast. I think that's how Tolkien phrased it. In a book called The Art of Thinking by Ernest Demnay, he says, quote, "Don't read good books. Life's too short for that. Only read the best," end quote. This is a principle that we can apply to pretty much everything in our lives. You know, life is too short to be filling it up with lots of time-draining, energy-sapping things. We should only read great books, not even the good ones, only the great ones. And we should only devote our might, our attention, and our precious time to great pursuits, things that have lasting value, real value, value for other people in many cases. So hopefully this will help you when you consider King Solomon's admonition there in Ecclesiastes 9:10 to remember that between the lines is the admonition, only take on as many things as you can do with your might. I'm Jeremiah Jacques. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Thank you for listening today. Feel free to send us your thoughts and questions about the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I'd like to thank our guests today, Brent Noctegal, Anthony Chibadirwe, and Andrew Miller. Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. Life has taught us that love does not consist in gazing at each other, but in looking outward together in the same direction. Thank you for joining us. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.